The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Friday, June 9th, 2017. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Today, Donald Trump, in a joint press conference with the president of Romania, gave this succinct, I counted it as about 140 characters, critique of James Comey's testimony.
No collusion, no obstruction. He's a leaker.
There wasn't much more of substance there. He called Comey a liar. When asked if he had taped anyone, the president said, "Oh, I'll tell you soon." He was teasing it like a season finale, a rose ceremony with tiny microphones hidden in each rose. Or not. We don't know. Who knows? And for the showman, Trump teased it some more.
"Oh, you're going to be very disappointed when you hear the end, so don't worry."
Ooh, I am intrigued. I'm going to be disappointed. Tell me less. You know, this guy should cut 1950s movie trailers. "Coming soon. Thrill to the non-existent exploits of a taping system. Hold on to your hats as you won't believe the amazing letdown. Ladies, hold your feller as the showman in chief promises a revelation that won't not disappoint. Like when David Copperfield didn't make the Statue of Liberty disappear because he was in Las Vegas and it was 12 years after the CBS special. Or when David Blaine ordered soup and a sandwich, not inside a box in any way. One of the great dazzling performers of our day performs his trademark three-dimensional chess. Like when Grandmaster Garry Kasparov faced down Big Blue. Not the IBM computer Big Blue, but a guy named Elmer, who is nicknamed Big Blue and can't play chess. The president promises to disappoint you at a later date. Are you not entertained?" No, not in the least. On the show today, the UK election. A man from Maidenhead with a bucket for a head. Democracy. Despair. Despair, good citizen. But first, Larry Wilmore, creator of The Bernie Mac Show, senior black correspondent for The Daily Show, host of The Nightly Show, is here to talk about the show he really was destined for. The medium he was aiming for all along, maybe without even knowing it. Podcaster. Black on the Air, host Larry Wilmore in studio up next. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general. And he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Larry Wilmore is black on the air. Actually, only half of that is true. He's black. But he's on a podcast. That's the name of his new podcast. I guess kind of in the cloud, but not necessarily on the air. You know Larry Wilmore from such TV shows as Sister Sister and others since then. Hello, Larry. Thanks for coming
I love
in.
That you go with the Sister Sister credit.
Yeah. I wanted to go
deep in
the well.
That's still got a lot of juice. Those twins are still tearing up showbiz.
I would say of the shows you were on, many appeal to similar, like overlapping audiences. Sure. And then that, if you had to map the universe of Larry shows, that is way out there.
Well, it's amazing. A show like Sister Sister, it was kind of, it had an appeal like Fresh Prince, actually, where multiple generations they just fell in love with those girls and they like following their lives and stuff. And they've been on other shows and they keep going back to reality shows because people just like them. They're just people that people like.
How was your persona as a senior black correspondent on The Daily Show different from your stand-up persona and your real-life persona?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. You know, I think if you're going to be successful at something, you have to find a core of yourself in whatever it is. And either you're doing an exaggeration of that core or you're extrapolating it in some way, you're pulling something from it. So senior black correspondent, we were trying to figure out, I remember trying to figure out how to do this first because Stephen had just left, I think, at Helms, those guys. And Stephen was the best at doing that. Stone Phillips, you know, fake correspondent, iron jaw type of sound like an anchor type of thing. He's really, his send up of that was brilliant, right? And very carefully observed and all that stuff. But Stephen was so good, he's in your ear when you're trying to do it, which is not good because you're doing a pale imitation of his thing. So you have to find what your thing is. And for me, I approached it from an acting point of view, you know, of, well, who am I? What's my point of view here? And somebody suggested, well, maybe you should be a Republican or that. I said, no, I don't want to be the opposite of what our expectations are. And I thought, well, my nature is to be contrary. You know, if the crowd is going with something, I'm very suspicious of that and I'm going to go somewhere else. But it's not always going to be the opposite so much as it's going to be contrary to what we're thinking, you know. And that once we got that, I knew, okay, so that's my point of view. I can always own that and I can always find the truth of something from that. And it's what I've always done in my work. And I didn't even know it until I had to put a definition on it, I realized, oh, I've done that my whole career.
So what in stand-up was, where do we see examples of contrarianism in your stand-up? Where would we have seen that?
Wow, now I gotta go way back, you know. I'll give you a very simple joke. When I talked about people would look at me because I'm light-skinned and they always ask me what I'm mixed with, you know, and they did that face, are you mixed with something? And I would say, look, if I was a beer, I'd be a Negro light. Okay. And I am a third less angry than the regular Negro. So, and it's the third less angry line that is kind of contrary to what you're thinking. Like, because the black comic was always angry.
Yeah. He had to be, especially in that era. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So the things that when you were black on stage, you were mad at Whitey. So that notion, what I was presenting on stage, was contrary to what Hollywood thought of a black comic. I was undercutting their idea of who I was, you know. Mm-hmm. I did that with all of my material. You thought it was going to be something, but it really kind of existed in a different area, whether I was talking about politics at the time or myself or whatever. And a lot of the jokes, some of them were one-liners, some of them were bits. My act was very satirical and silly and some of it was straightforward and that type of thing too.
And this is why audiences loved you, but Hollywood didn't know what the hell to do with you.
Yeah, I did really well in clubs because it was a real hodgepodge of just fun, funny stuff, you know. And you just didn't know where it was going to go. And I had so many different types of influences, and I think I put all of those influences in my act. Like, I could do like straight up political comedy in one breath, and then in the other, I would have the audience start doing the same. Okay, I want everybody to clap their hands over here. Okay, now I'm going to divide the audience in half. Keep going. Now this half, I want you to do your arms like this. Go, woo, ooh, ooh. Okay, now everybody, this, do your arms like this. Go, woo. Okay, everybody, you got to do it. And then I would turn around and I go, and I turn back, go, keep going, keep going, keep going. And I turn around like I'm about to start. And I go, keep going. And I go, and they're doing this, woo, woo, woo. And they're doing all this. And then I would turn around and I would tell them this. I would put my hands up for them to stop. And it was like a 10-second pause before I spoke. And I would say, I have no idea for this. I'm really sorry, you guys. I'm really sorry. I apologize to you. I have no idea at all. I didn't even know what I was thinking.
Yeah. Woo, woo.
I don't know why I had you do that, but you guys looked hilarious. I mean, what did you think I was going to do? What did you think I was going to do? But the audience loved that because I took them on a little, you know, conceptual journey. Yep. So a lot of my humor is conceptual too, where I'm setting up an expectation for you. And then it's met. And once again, that had a contrary ending.
Yeah.
You know, it went against your expectation in a way that you couldn't predict.
That's Andy Kaufman or Steve Martin-esque.
Those were part of my influences too, as much as.
Where in the act would you do that, by the way? Would you bust that out early?
No, that would come about 3/4 of the way through, because that's when, see, here's how a comic thinks. That's when they're handing out checks and people are signing checks. So they,
What do they call that? The check break? Or
exactly.
Check break's a killer.
You can't do all your subtle, clever material. You got to be hitting them over the head with stuff.
I have this observation, and tell me if it's right or wrong, but please tell me it's right.
I'm sure it is right.
I found that if you look at the different personas of the Daily Show correspondents, the over-the-top buffoonish opposite of who they were the white guys, whereas you and Jessica and Wyatt and Samantha, none of you did that. None of you were really – I mean, you were crazy in different ways, and maybe Samantha was saying things that she wouldn't necessarily agree with, yet you really got a sense of her.
She was almost the sex potty type of thing early on. Yeah. She did that move a lot.
But Steve Carell was far dumber than he is, and Stephen Colbert was like a mean blowhard. And even John Oliver played the blowhard, and it was – I think that there might be something, it might be a lot of things, but there might be something to the stakes of a black performer being the opposite. Like if you were a Larry Elder type, maybe it would be harder for you to live with yourself than if Stephen Colbert were his
character. Well, it's interesting because I wouldn't have a problem with that, but I think it would have had a shorter shelf life at the time.
Yeah.
For me, it would have been boring because it just would have been taking the opposite. But a character that I want to do at some point, like, if I were to do a different version of The Nightly Show that didn't have to follow what Stephen was doing, because Stephen was playing a character, and I thought the best thing for me to do is to be real.
Yes.
Because as my producer head always leads my performer ego all the time. Like, I have a horrible performer ego, but I have a very confident producer head, And I was like,
so meaning you think you did worse than you did as a performer?
I always think I did horrible as a performer.
But can't your producer side then intellectually know it did well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yep. Completely. But the performer ego is very frail, and it needs way too much assurances, so I don't
Was this true when you were doing Titus Andronicus and Shakespeare?
Titus Andronicus. Every performer, by the way, feels this way. Yeah. So luckily, I have the producer side, so I'm not a crazy person.
Right.
Right? Because that's what drives a lot of performers crazy, is because they need that assurance from the audience that everything's okay, right? But my producer side said, I have to be almost the opposite of Stephen, in the way I'm delivering comedy. Mm-hmm. If I try to do a character, there's too much comparison going on. But if I didn't have that comparison, a character I would have loved to have done is that black sheriff who's on Fox News.
Clark.
I would have loved doing the black sheriff show.
Just put a hat on you.
Yes.
That's halfway there.
I would have loved to have done it. And I actually will do that character at some point because it's just a very funny character. Now, that character's funny to me because he's not just like Larry Elder. He's a radio show host, but he's more of a dry to me when I think of, not that he's a dry personality, but it's one note. But the sheriff is fantastic. He's a sheriff, for Christ's sakes. Yeah. He's got like medals.
And his hat.
He's got to be the sheriff of someplace,
And his hat is very embroidered.
Yes.
Like, it's not just a plain hat.
But also, he must have a backstory. You're like, what's the sheriff's backstory? So this is a whole world you can invent for a character. And you can do that opposite ideology at the same time. So it has both of those things that, to me, makes for funny comedy.
What's the best way to explore that? In a skit?
I might do it on my podcast. I'm thinking of maybe doing a couple of characters on the podcast. I might start doing the sheriff.
Good. What's the podcast about?
It's me basically just talking to interesting people like yourself. I love talking to people and I love interviewing. It's something I wish I could have done more on The Nightly Show, but we were in that kind of round table format.
Yeah.
It wasn't even a round table. It was like three people.
I did it once.
Triangle. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about. But it was very frustrating, to have 5 minutes to have that discussion.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was very frustrating. We just get started and it's like, that kind of thing happens. But to be able to talk to someone for 45 minutes, one person, and you can really find out who they are and present them to the audience is very exciting.
As I compare the Black on the Air with The Nightly Show, here's another observation. Tell me what you think.
Yes,
I think that
sir.
The Nightly Show, because of when it came out, was a lot about...
I already agree with you. I know exactly what you're
Well, it was a lot about subtle racism, like subtle pointing out instances of subtle racism. And 2017 is so much about overt racism.
Yeah.
And it's not that we took our eye off the overt while paying attention to the subtle. There's no reason to fault anyone for paying attention to what was subtle.
Right.
But man, that overt racism reared up and gave us President Trump, essentially.
Yeah. From my point of view, it's just racism.
racism.
Right, exactly. That was a very subtle lynching that just happened over there. It was very, it was just subtle, No, not to knock the bad. I know exactly what it is that because you had Obama there, that racism wasn't on people's mind in the same way, you know, whereas Trump just doles it out like it's, you know, candy at a quinceañera. You put in a piñata, you just bust open and it's going everywhere. But my lament is that we weren't on the air to cover that with the group that I had. We had such a good group.
Did you think it was going to happen because of who you are? Just
what do you mean?
Did you think that Trump was going to happen because you saw Nate Silver's polls, because you read the national mood, or more because of who you are and what you know in your bones?
Yeah, maybe like a dog sensing the earthquake is coming type of thing, if that's what you're talking about. I've been a huge politics fan for a long time, and the presidency I'm fascinated with, you know, and how people get elected and why those things happen, why it's inevitable that we had a George Bush, an Obama, and a Trump. I mean, that they all follow each other, and Clinton. It's fascinating to me. I find elections more a reaction to previous elections than a contest between the parties.
So true.
You know, so I never considered Trump running against Hillary so much as he was running against the legacy of Obama.
Right.
And the Obama years. That's what he was really running against. And that's what people were really electing. And Hillary never made the case. We didn't know whether she was continuing that legacy or if she was running against it.
Yeah, she was trying to thread so many things rather than just boldly saying, even risking making a mistake, in the next four years of Obama. And if you don't like Obama, you're wrong because he got us out of the recession.
She didn't make that case.
She never made that case. She never made any bold case.
She did
case.
A little bit at the end.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders, interestingly enough, ran against Obama and the Obama legacy.
Mm-hmm.
He actually did.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted to tear down the whole system. The last person I can remember, and even Al Gore ran away from Clinton, as you recall. You know, he kept him on the sidelines, you know, because the whole Monica Lewinsky thing, and a lot of people think he was hurt by that. He didn't even win his own state. The last person to fully embrace...
Well, Tennessee was not trending Democrat
for
a while.
But he would have won with Tennessee!
Yeah. Although he's probably been in Tennessee less than most people said to be from a state.
I've been there more than he has,
I think so.
Both of us have.
Anyone with season tickets, too, say. The natural predators might have been there.
The first... George H.W. Bush ran as Reagan's third term.
Because Reagan is charismatic and George H.W. Bush was George H.W. Bush. But yeah, that's right.
But if Gore had won in the Clinton economy, I believe he could have won.
Right. Gore's message was something like, what's wrong with peace and prosperity? Should have said, and Clintonism.
And he seemed to be ashamed of, you know, maybe rightly so, of all the Clinton stuff. But he just didn't even have to think about all that. So,
right.
You know. Yeah. But anyhow, that's all the forensics of all that stuff. But Trump, to me, was more of a reaction to Obama. And the cynicism of it that I really didn't like was the whole birther thing and the energy around the birther movement that he started.
Ugh.
And that energy, like the way he talked to Megyn Kelly, to me, the reaction that audience had was that same energy in the Obama stuff. That, to me, that ugly kind of energy where he's misogynistic and people are cheering.
Yeah, and I guess we told ourselves, sure, 25, 30, 35% of the country, and mostly in the Republican Party, that'll be quarantined there. And it wasn't true.
But it's amazing. If there hadn't been so many candidates, I wonder if it would have been the same, because he was able to do well with 25%.
That is true.
Look how long he had 25% and he won.
Right.
Yeah.
But the other candidates were preventing other people from popping also.
Yeah.
I would say the big thing was he nailed immigration. In a way, the Republican Party was out of step with their voter.
They were aching to hear that.
Yeah.
I agree.
Right. And that's a fault that's in my... opinion, you know, there's immoral elements to that,
right,
but he
that.
Nailed the big question that activated their emotions.
Is what I disagree with my good friend, not to drop a name, but Senator Bernie Sanders. I have a slight disagreement on that, where the part of his message that resonated the most was not about trade and about those missing jobs in Appalachia. It was about immigration.
Yeah.
I agree with you completely.
But I understand why Bernie would say otherwise. Would he naturally think otherwise, because he has the trade message. And so for him to say, look how well Trump resonated on trade, this is what I'm saying, it validates a lot of Bernie's agenda.
And people slam the Democratic Party for engaging in identity politics. But it's okay when the identity is white working class people.
Well, that's not an identity.
That identity
that's
is.
Just the that's just okay. who we
well,
are,
Larry,
naturally.
Larry, those are just normal people.
Those are
come
the
on.
Normal people.
That's the heartland, Larry. It's
you know
the
what,
heartland.
You know what one thing that bothered me, and I bet it
well, I wonder if it bothered you, how Trump would always say, look at how bad race relations have gotten under Obama. And this would drive me crazy. And there were polls, and it drove me crazy extra because people like Chuck Todd or the people, you know, John Dickerson would say, well, look at this poll. The polls of Americans do say race relations have gotten worse. Wait, what is how do you poll race relations? Does that mean that could mean I hate black people more, so I'm going to say they've gotten worse. That could mean I perceive that black people don't like me more. That could be, oh, I'm doing fine, but definitely I see some stuff over here. It's a terrible poll. It's really cynical. Yeah. I don't think they did get worse. I think maybe people don't understand how progress works.
Correct. I would agree with that. It's a white-centric question.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, are you more aware of racism, white people, now than before Obama? Yes! And we don't like that.
Right.
Stop taking your cameras out, black people, and showing us racism. Would you stop it, please? I don't want to be aware of that. And plus, Obama wasn't like the black janitor. It wasn't his job to come in and clean up, like, 300 years of racism in 4 years, for Christ's sakes.
He wasn't the mystical black man.
Yeah, exactly. Spread, magical Negro is going to get rid of racism. Yeah. Why is that his job? You know, especially with the economy tanking, his first job is to wipe out racism.
Yeah. Last question. Big one.
What?
What do you think? I want satire to be funny.
Yes.
How do you think satire can be effective, if it can at all, in bringing about any sort of political change?
Well, I have to disagree with the premise of that. The thought that's satire's job, I think, is a faulty premise. It's given too big of a job to satire. Satire's job is to make you laugh.
Yes.
Now, if you want satire to do other things like work at a gas station and, you know, go clean people's houses and that, you got to sit down with satire and have a good talk with it and let it know it has other job descriptions, you know. But when satire signed up to do its job, they said, okay, satire, we just need you to be funny and insightful. Yeah. Good. I'm in. Yeah. Count me in.
I never said I knew Excel.
And
what's
could you also
on?
Make people change their mind? No, wait. No. That's not what I signed up for. Satire did not sign up for that. People are giving that to satire, you know. So I don't think that's the job of satire. I think that's the job of voting. I think it's the job of organizing. I think it's the job of activism. I think it's the job of information, shows like this or whatever, you know. But it is not the job of satire.
Larry Wilmore, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There are over 90,000 people missing at any time, and over 500,000 are reported missing every year. And that's just in the United States. I'm Mike Morford.
And I'm Jess Betancourt. And in our podcast, Missing Persons, we discuss cases of people who have gone missing under mysterious circumstances. And we're joined in each episode by guests who are either related to the missing person, investigating their disappearance, or advocating for answers in the case.
Missing Persons is available everywhere you listen to podcasts, and there are dozens of episodes to binge on right now. Subscribe today so you don't miss an episode.
And now the spiel. We hereby announce Lord and Lady Buckethead.
Lord Buckethead. He ran against British Prime Minister Theresa May. He lost badly. To be fair, even if he had won all the Buckethead demographic in his district, he still would have trailed by a lot. This is part of the British tradition of all comers being allowed a place on the ballot, though if they don't get a certain threshold of the vote, they do not get reimbursed. So there, next to Theresa May, just like next to Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn in his district, were some freakazoids. Jeremy Corbyn was flanked by a man named Nigel Knapp. He is a member of, well, listen,
the official Monster Raving Loony Party.
The Monster Raving Loony Party, or as we call it, the Tea Party. That party was also represented in Theresa May's district in Maidenhead.
Hope Allen, known as Howlin' Lord Hope, the official Monster Raving Loony Party, 119.
Yeah. Now, the thing is that when that particular result was announced, it wasn't clear among who the people standing on stage with Theresa May was representing the Raving Loonies, because next to her was a guy in a t-shirt with Free Someone, whose name I don't recognize, a guy in a huge Elmo suit, he wound up getting 3 votes, a guy dressed like the English version of Boss Hogg meets Benny Hill, and a guy who dressed as if Darth Vader mated with Beaker from the Muppets. Then it became clear who that particular fellow was.
Harvey Jonathan David, known as Lord Buckethead, 249.
And then Lord Buckethead dabbed. To be clear, Lord Buckethead is not an actual lord. His head is not an actual bucket. It's more like a cylindrical solid with a slit for eyes. And why is this guy running for the House of Commons anyway? Shouldn't Lord Buckethead be in the House of Buckets? The British election was a semi-endorsement of buckets, a quasi-repudiation of Theresa May, a perhaps cautious embrace of Jeremy Corbyn and his Labour Party. The Conservatives were rejected, probably because of ill will over Brexit, but the Conservatives did really well in Scotland, where they overwhelmingly voted against Brexit. Now, you will hear different analyses of the strains of voting blocks and the issues that shaped this election. There was a youth surge. The Conservatives mismanaged their message. But I have a more unified theory of what went on. And it is true not just of the UK and not just of this vote in the UK or the Brexit vote in the UK, also true of France and the Netherlands and the US. You ready? Whatever we voted for last time, we're against it this time. The electorate does not like it. And the electorate wants everyone to know they don't like it. It's not true of everyone in the electorate, but it's true of enough people to sway the votes. Some people stayed home, then they come out. Some people voted one way, then they voted another. People who never voted National Front did, or never voted Tory, or never voted for Geert Wilders. Then they did vote for Geert, or Le Pen, or Tory. They voted Obama. Then they voted Trump. Lots of different explanations about why this happened. But my main unifying theory is this. The voters are against the people they elected last time. And this is where I, as a careful observer of human nature, a booster of democracy, am supposed to say, and you know what it all adds up to? That glorious way in which we keep our leaders accountable. But I am beginning to think it is more a schizoid way that we never commit to a decent course of action. The worst we say about democracy is something like, well, it's the worst system except for all others. And that really lets democracy off the hook, doesn't it? Look, today I was stuck for 39 minutes in a tunnel under the East River. I guess I could say, well, that A train, it's the worst train except for all the others, except this. A train sucks. It sucks. And sometimes democracy sucks. Usually, if we admit it sucks in little ways here or there, we have these built-in excuses like, you know, it sucks because the wisdom of the people has been short-circuited by advertising or big dollars. Or if the voters decide wrong, it's because some malefactor convinced them that their vote wasn't worth it or that the system disenfranchises voters. And this all limits true democracy. It's not that some of these aren't true in some ways, but overall, the problem with democracy is democracy. I mean, the biggest reason why democracy sucks is because the people constantly decide wrong. Not always, not even most of the time, but a lot of the time. They choose the worst policy outcome, and they do it for a lot of reasons. Some of these reasons, they were misled, the choices were hard, they are stupid, or I think this is a big one, they can't possibly invest enough time to acquire the expertise in all these complicated areas. So basically, we have a system that often chooses worse policy instead of better policy, and we're supposed to say, that's okay, because the people chose it. Who cares if the people chose it? I want the good policy. There is a benefit to people feeling empowered. And in the overall assessment of what's a good system, I think you should take that into account. That if people feel empowered, even if they're, you know, choosing to build a road on the left side of town instead of the right side of town, and the right side would have been better, the empowerment, that has some sway. But that's not really what's going on. We're not making close choices where things are almost as good as the other. We're just deciding wrong over and over again. Now, listen, I'm not a monarchist, I'm not an elitist, I'm not a theocrat, I might be an elitist, it depends how you define it. But let us be honest, we are constantly choosing bad politicians. Why? You will hear a million excuses. I'll tell you why. Because we're bad voters. We can't admit that we're bad voters. We admit this with all other areas of life where public choice is at stake. What song is at number one? Is it the best song? I don't know. There's a whole lot of reasons why songs go to number one, and very rarely is it because it's the best song. Or in an era a little before our own, when there weren't 2,000 television stations and unlimited streaming stations and all shows got to stay on forever, when they would cancel shows for bad ratings and renew shows for good ratings, the shows that kept getting renewed, the popular shows, were terrible shows often, Beverly Hillbillies and I Dream of Jeannie, and they kept getting renewed because they were favored by the most people, even though they sucked. And we got that, and we admitted that, and we didn't fool ourselves about it, and we didn't say, TV networks are the best system except for all others. People are often wrong. When the choice is a politician, we have to buy into a fiction that the crowd is wise, that the system works, or if it doesn't work, it's because a voting machine broke down, or a Russian told you that the Pope endorsed Donald Trump. What a government should do, however it gets there, is to pick the best policies. I mean, look, it's infrastructure week, as you know. I don't have to tell you this. Did you know that we haven't raised the gas tax since 1993? I don't mean as a percentage. It's like the same 18 cents since 1993. And gas is relatively cheap, and we have fuel-efficient cars, so we spend less gas. This is how we fund the roads. We fund the roads via the gas tax, yet we never raise the gas tax. Why not? Fundamentally, because your fellow voters are miscalculating. Because democracy is screwing us. Occasionally, it's killing us. Bridge collapses. But in general, it's certainly making us sit in clogged intersections with no good solution. Because raising a gas tax is an action that voters would punish. It wouldn't take a lying politician. It wouldn't take a dishonest politician. It would just take a politician saying, that guy wants to raise the gas tax. And that guy who wants to do the right thing would be voted out of office. And that is just one of hundreds of examples. Another example of democracy not being that great, midterm elections. The president's party almost always loses seats. Presidents, what, they're always bad in their first 2 years? Nope. Is it always a good corrective? That's not the case either. It's just vacillating human nature that says, I want chocolate. Nah, I'm sick of chocolate. Give me vanilla. Or in the case of American politics, replace chocolate and vanilla with Democrats or Republicans. Meh, Republicans and Democrats. I'm going by demographics. Or in British politics, where it's Labour and Conservatives, they vacillate widely between two disparate worldviews based mostly on, did we zig last time? We got to zag this time. It's hard to have a system of the people rule when so many of the people drool. It's the demos, not the crassy. And yes, I do agree that it is the best system, but only by a little bit, and not always. I've looked into the political science. There was a philosopher named Jason Brennan who wrote a book called Against Democracy. It's not a slam dunk, but he does raise a number of trenchant critiques. There's a whole bunch of myths about democracy, and he really explodes them. It makes us better people. It makes us more attuned to our fellow man. It gives us a feeling of empowerment. All those things are demonstrably not true. And because they're not true, and once you understand and read a lot of literature about how they're not true, that they kind of make us more clannish and less willing to give a hand to our fellow man, fine. Once you believe that, you say, well, then what should a system of government do? It should, I guess, deliver the best results for the most people. There are other ways to frame that, but that's a pretty good system, some sort of idea of utilitarianism, or if you're born randomly in a society, which is the best society you would want to be in. And it's just not clear that democracy does the best in getting you there. The downside of non-democracies, though, is bigger. I will say that. And that is the best reason why democracy is better than the others, because democracies do tend to avoid famines and war with each other. So in terms of just presenting calamities, they do seem superior to other systems of government. Beyond that, I don't know. Singapore and China have done a lot better for their citizens than their more democratic neighbors. Anyway, I say, have at it, UK. You've a hung parliament, now unhang it. And as for American democratic partisans, they seem to be getting a lot out of it, huh? Like identities, right? Now we could call ourselves nasty women or deplorables. The T-shirt or at least Twitter hashtag industry is going bonkers. Democracy gave us that. Maybe I'm just put off by the fact that Elmo didn't even reach double digits. James Comey called our democracy glorious and messy. Lately, it has been a parade of horribles, or a basket of deplorables, or even a buckethead of unsensibles. And
And that's it for today's show. Chris Berube was going to vote Lord Buckethead, not the guy around in England, but the Guns N' Roses offshoot band. If just producer Mary Wilson is upset, it's because we gave short shrift to this fella.
Commonly known as Mr. Fishfinger, Independent 309.
Steve Lickteig, executive producer of Slate Podcast, points out that Mr. Fishfinger's amorphic costume would allow him to run in future elections as Mr. Julianne Carrot. Please follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/slategist. I have been on there interacting with you guys like 3 times this week, and I'm going to push it up to 5, I swear. The Gist. British elections might not select a good leader, but they do at least provide us with a balanced diet. Oompuru depuru du peru, and thanks for listening.